From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Good morning, I'm John Hingsbergen. In the Commonwealth of Kentucky, there are about 11,000, maybe 11,300 Jewish citizens. We're told that that's about 0.3% of the state's population. On this final day of Hanukkah, we've chosen to focus on Judaism, its role in the history of Kentucky, as well as during the 21st century. We're welcoming to the studio two guests. They are Rabbi Mark Klein, Rabbi of Temple Adath Israel, if I can pronounce it correctly. Rabbi Mark ordained in 1995. He served on many boards and committees in the Lexington area, and in his relatively few years in the community has demonstrated his commitment to diversity and to the community. Thank you for being with us, Rabbi Mark.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Rosie Musnick, sociologist and author. Rosie is the author of Arab and Jewish Women of Kentucky, Stories of Accommodation and Audacity. She has a PhD in sociology and has done some teaching at UK as well as other activities in the community. Rosie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
During our program, we are going to encourage, as always, our listeners to be part of the conversation. If you have questions, comments, stories you'd like to tell, I always like to emphasize the concept of personal stories, something that you would like to share with us during the show. Please feel free to pick up the telephone line and call 800. Let's do it this way. I get confused because I give one phone number early in the week before the live show, telling listeners to call in and leave a message, and then the other during the live broadcast. That's 800-621-8890. We're not quite ready to put calls on the air, but if you get on the line, we will welcome you to the program with your question, your comment, or your personal story. Do feel free to write to us right now, WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Send us a tweet at WEKUEST or post on Facebook, and you're welcome and encouraged to do that after the program as well. But we want to talk about Judaism in general and maybe get into some specifics. We'll talk a little bit about Hanukkah, this time of the year, and why it occurs this time of the year, and it's perceived in our culture as related to the winter holidays of Christmas and the New Year and so forth. But let's just start with some general terms, and I think we toss that to the rabbi first to define Judaism. Is it a religion, a race or nationality, a culture?
It's not a race. You can't convert in or out of a race. It is more than a culture because different pieces of the world will celebrate Judaism differently. It is certainly a tradition. Religion is a difficult word because it is really the Christian tradition breeds the English language, and religion connotes something strictly related to God. But Judaism is part cultural, part theology, part way of living, part community, part citizenship. I guess I would best define it as a standard living ethically in the world, recognizing a community that makes sense in service.
So there are actually, I've encountered or interacted with Jews who may not believe in God or who are agnostics, although they identify as Jews. So they don't consider that, in that situation, a religion.
I don't think there's such a thing as an atheist. I think everyone has faith because you set an alarm clock, and that means you're leaving to some other source the power to make sure that there's a tomorrow, and you believe so strongly that it's going to happen that you prepare to be there, leaving it to that other source to make it happen. We look both ways before we cross the road. We don't wear blindfolds. You know, we believe that there's a partnership, certainly, not God controlling everything. But I think everyone has faith in each other in some process. But yes, to answer your question, there is the absolute within Judaism, a gradation of theology from people who do believe that God is the old man on the mountain with the beard and the whole thing, and people who think that divinity is the force of nature that finds us in communion with each other and everything in between.
And I know there are numerous divisions within Judaism, at least in terms of the religious practice. You talk about God as the old man with the beard. There are many Jewish people we may encounter in some major population areas like New York City, who culturally dress differently, have always have a beard, maybe wear what we consider culturally Americans, funny outfits that stand out as culturally different. I guess those are Orthodox Jews and their various brands of orthodoxy. You are a Reform Jew yourself?
I'm a Reform Jew. The question of dress is more uniform to your commitment to this Rebbe's teachings versus this Rebbe. And whether the coat is blue or black or short or long and the sideburns are curled in front or curled behind the ear, what kind of hat you have, etc., all of those are indications of which camp you're really in within the ultra-Orthodox world. That said, how we live Jewishly has nothing to do with which of the movements in which you participate. There are Reform Jews that will keep strictly kosher, and the Orthodox Jews that, well, I finished my meat, now I want my ice cream. They may not serve them together, but within seconds of each other. So it's really tied to how we see our partnership with God and tradition. And Martin Buber said that each of us has our own I-thou relationship with God and with tradition. And so the funny thing about Judaism is there's this joke, you have three Jews, you have 15 opinions. And what's really funny is that it's not a joke, it's true, because things are circumstantial. Truth is found in the integrity of the person following, not in whose standard you adhere to or don't.
All right, a little bit of the basics underway with Rabbi Mark Klein. And we may talk, I don't know, maybe a little theology, a little culture, and we invite you, our listeners, to get on board. We may define some terms. You've already tossed out a word, kosher, which I think most people in our culture recognize as a dietary approach.
It means ritually fit, and it can apply to food. It can apply to your toilet paper if you really want to. It means that things were prepared in a process that was supervised and makes sense according to some rabbinic authority.
Okay, and we may define, and hopefully we'll define some other terms as we progress in today's Eastern Standard. Our email address, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Our phone number, feel free to get on the line at 800-621-8890. Also with us, Rosie Musnick. And Rosie is a sociologist and author. Again, you wrote this book about I guess, Arabs and Jews in Kentucky. Tell us, let's start by talking a little bit about the background of your interest in putting together a book of this type.
Why did I write that book? Also, the rabbi's wearing a yarmulke. You can add that. He has a skull cap on, which is an oddity in Kentucky.
It's a multicolored one, too.
It's beautiful, Rabbi.
Thank you.
It's beautiful.
Thanks, Rosie. I appreciate
it. You're welcome,
you.
Rabbi. But anyway, I wrote this book because I'm a Jewish Kentuckian. And also because my father, Monroe Musnick, taught for many years at Transylvania University. And I'm really proud of him because he befriended numerous students, and among them were members of one Palestinian Christian family, the Ackles. And they sent one member of their family after another to Transy as a safe school. Literally, that's what Musa Ackle, the elder of the family, felt Transy was a safe school. And we became very, very close friends. In fact, Musa Ackle, the elder in the family, I called him Sido, which is Arabic for grandfather. So when I was a grad student at UK, every Friday afternoon, I would go to his apartment, which was on the edge of campus at Rose and Maxwell, and we would have tea together, and he would tell me stories, and he would tell me about peddling goods. He would peddle fine linens and rugs throughout the American South. He would talk about taking a boat ride from New York to Palestine, which would take a month, and how he fell in love with a Jewish woman on one of those boat rides, which was an impossible relationship, as you might expect. And I realized in talking to him that we really had similar immigrant tales, and particularly when it came to peddling, because my Lithuanian grandfather came to Kentucky. First, he peddled through Mississippi, and he had goods on his back, and then he went to a cart to eventually to a store. And so in hearing Sido's stories, I realized that ours were very similar, that they cross paths.
Very fascinating. And we, with you, Rosie, want to talk a little bit about the status of Jews in Kentucky. I mean, Kentucky's, I guess, different than some of the neighboring states. Like Ohio, you might find Jewish populations and kind of spread out in various locales around the state. Indiana, perhaps the same. Kentucky, I would say there are places where where some citizens may never meet a Jew. Would you say that's true?
Yes, I would say that's true.
And, oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, I mean, we're the oddities here, right? We're not your typical minorities, unlike, you know, New York, where most people think of New York as being a Jewish city. New York City is a Jewish city.
So we're likely to find the Jewish population in Kentucky in Lexington,
in Louisville. But that historically has not always been true. So like when my grandfather came in the late 1800s and early 1900s, people went to where they could make a living. So you had Jews throughout Kentucky in rural communities. My family started out in Nicholasville and then went to Versailles. And so you had Jews throughout the state in eastern Kentucky, western Kentucky. And over time, as we have prospered more, we've left those rural communities. We're no longer shopkeepers as much. And so, like a lot of people, have left rural communities.
We want to talk about Hanukkah. We want to talk about Judaism, Jewish culture, and we'd like to hear your stories and your questions, of course, for Rabbi Mark Klein or Rosie Musnick during the rest of this hour on Eastern Standard. 800-621-8890 is our phone number. Feel free to get on board, and we'll be putting callers on the air shortly, and as well as emails that are sent to WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Converse with us on Facebook at the WEKU site there, or send us a tweet at WEKUEST. Again, 800-621-8890 or WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Of course, 40 seconds before our station break, Rabbi Mark Klein, briefly, what is Hanukkah to Jews?
It's really a minor festival. It's a celebration of the rededication of the temple after the Syrian Greeks trashed it. There's a mythology that goes along with this, that, you know, the 8 days of oil, but that story doesn't happen until roughly 500 years after the event. But it's a minor festival. The major piece of it, though, is it celebrates faith and strength over might.
We're going to come back, and I think we'll pick up the topic of Hanukkah after a brief station break. We have much more coming during this week's Eastern Standard on WEKU. The phone number again, 800-621-8890.
David Lee Roth lights the menorah. So do James Conkirk Douglas and the late Dinah Shore. Guess who eats together at the Carnegie Deli? Bowser from Shanana and Arthur Fonzarelli.
This is Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm John Hingsbergen with our guests, Rabbi Mark Klein and Rosie Musnick, and talking Hanukkah and Judaism. Of course, Adam Sandler has culturally popularized Hanukkah, I guess, in a fashion with the little tune that he worked up. I guess he did that for the TV show for Saturday Night Live a number of years ago. But Rabbi Mark Klein, back to the topic of Hanukkah. It's a minor Jewish festival.
It is a minor festival, made big, I guess, because of its location roughly in time to American Christmas. The Jewish calendar is a lunar solar calendar, and so the months are based on the lunar system, but we don't want to celebrate the fall harvest in the middle of the winter, or in January or so. So there's corrections put in. 7 out of every 19 years, there's an extra month added so that the dates will travel. This is the earliest that Hanukkah really has ever come. And next year it'll launch back to be much later again because of the added month. It's a time for us to think about dedication. It's a time for us to remember that there are people who are bent on their own egos, and on having the world their way, and The rededication story of the temple reminds us that it's about all of us and not some of us. I might add a footnote that the piece that you just played from Adam Sandler's song, mm-hmm. Bowser's not the only member of Sha-na-na. One of the founding members of Sha-na-na, Alan Cooper, also was the dean of the graduate school at Hebrew Union College. You wouldn't think of a Bible scholar being a founder of Sha-na-na. We're everywhere.
And in some ways visible, in some ways invisible.
Well, yeah, Dina de Malchuta Dina, that's a phrase from the Talmud. It means the law of the land you live in is the law you live by. And our most sacred task in the world is to be relevant citizens in our community, to help move the world to a place that's more ethical by the way we live. And that doesn't always mean calling attention to the fact that, hey, I'm Jewish. It means doing whatever is needed to make sure the community benefits from who we are and that we're there.
We're talking Judaism and also Hanukkah on this week's Eastern Standard. Let's pause for just a moment now. For an essay that WEKU aired, actually, it's about 3 years ago. The spirit of giving infuses the holiday season, but essayist Leslie Gutman, who's a freelance reporter and has done some work for WEKU and other stations, of course, Leslie found some giving comes unscheduled, prompted by unusual and unforeseen events.
This is a story about a star and a bolt of lightning and what happened after they met. The thunderstorm was wild and sweeping. It was bigger than anyone had seen in a long time. Lightning reached out and struck the six-pointed Star of David that stood atop Temple Adith Israel. The stone exploded into a few big pieces and 1,000 little pieces. Temple Adith Israel has been in Lexington for over 100 years and on Ashland Avenue for more than 80. For the first time since anyone could remember, it was a temple without a star. The temple started investigating how to replace the star, but for one reason or another, a series of obstacles prevented timely replacement. Meanwhile, a phone call was made to Emmanuel Gilpin over at Gilpin Masonry. Emmanuel, who's known around the bluegrass as Gil, had done some work on the temple a few years earlier, and the temple thought he'd know what kind of material the star had been made of. Concrete, for example, might be too heavy. Gil is in his early 50s and grew up in Lexington, attending Ashland Baptist Church. At that time, his church was down the street from the temple. Gil remembers his mom telling him about neighborhoods in the bluegrass in the 1940s and 1950s that would put up big signs saying, "No Jews." On the phone, Gil identified the fallen star as being made of Indiana limestone. The call ended, and that was that. But it wasn't. After the phone call, for two mornings in a row, Gil woke up in bed with a strong feeling that he should be the one to replace the star. Something said to him, "You should fix this." Gil told me it was as simple or as complicated as that. I don't usually wake up with those kinds of impressions on my mind. I told my wife, "I feel we should donate this." The largest piece of the broken star now sat in a temple member's garden. Gil came out and measured, figured out the new dimensions, and drove 2.5 hours to an Indiana quarry where a craftsman carved a new star. It cost a couple $1,000s. I met Gil at a Friday night Shabbat service when he was honored for replacing our star. He and his wife sat in the front row looking shy. Later, he told me that although he was honored to be there, he also felt like a hillbilly. He'd never been to a Jewish service before. Jewish people are still a minority in central Kentucky, maybe 2,500 people out of a population of 250,000. The discrimination and anti-Semitism Gil's mom told him about doesn't exist anymore, but scraps remain, mostly from lack of knowledge. It can be in passing, like people using the phrase "Jew you down" when referring to bargaining, or scheduling major work events on our high holy days. When stuff like that happens, even if unintentional, it hurts. While Gil doesn't think what he did was a big deal, his action took away a big chunk of that hurt for me, in the way a drop of food coloring will transform a glass of water. Other people I know at the temple felt the same way. This story with Gil happened a few years ago, and since then, it feels like the news has gotten even worse about divisiveness in our country and intolerance on our planet. But maybe what's just as true is that on quiet, unobtrusive streets, ordinary people wake up in the morning with ideas they've never had before that end up connecting their communities. Like lightning in the dark, they illuminate everything around them.
Essayist Leslie Gutman on WEKU's Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. Guests in the studio are Rabbi Mark Klein and Rosie Musnick, and you're invited to be part of the program by calling 800-621-8890. Send us an email to wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. We're going to go to the phone in just a quick moment here, but Rosie and Rabbi Mark, Leslie refers to a touching story of folks of different cultures and backgrounds working together, but she, you know, toward the very end mentions that there's still divisiveness and intolerance. Do Jews in Kentucky experience intolerance, or do they find that they're not accepted in some cultures, but some areas of the state?
Wow, that's a heavy question, isn't it, Rabbi?
Certainly is.
Oh, is there
still... Not wanting to put you on the spot.
Yep, don't put me on the spot about that one. You know, I don't know if I would say it's blatant intolerance, as maybe it once was, that Jews experienced not just in Kentucky, but everywhere. I would say things are much more subtle. And I was thinking as I was driving here about a friend's son when he was 14 years old and didn't want to identify being Jewish anymore. He said, I don't want to be Jewish. And I joked with him and I said, okay, do you want to be identified as Muslim? And he goes, oh, that's worse. Hmm. And so that said something to me. It said that he was still getting the message that it was not a great thing to be Jewish and he needed to distance himself from it. And so, yes, I think those messages are still there. How the form they take and how they're expressed may be different than it was in previous generations.
I think some of it's still very overt in pockets. 30 years ago, to have a social life in Lexington, if you weren't a member, if you were Jewish and not a member of the Temple or the Synagogue, you were really shunned from a lot of places in town. I think that's changed a lot. But I think there's a remnant ignorance, and I don't want to call it intolerance. There are certainly places that are overtly intolerant, and I won't even call it anti-Semitic because that's a racial term, but anti-Jewish. And you still hear from some pulpits that the Jews killed Christ and all of that mythology. But there's a remnant ignorance, and people are afraid of what they don't understand. And sometimes it's a matter of Christian privilege. People are not intending to be difficult, but they speak a language based on the commonality of their culture that ends up being exclusive of anybody outside of their culture. And we talk about racially in terms of white privilege. Most white people are not racists, but yet we perpetuate standards. So I think that's really one of the big issues that we face, is there's this ignorance that still exists. I think another problem, candidly, is that there are Jewish families that haven't educated our next generations to appreciate who they are. And so all that Judaism means is this label that is misunderstood or not understood. And so when the children are asked, what does it mean? They have no answers. And so there's this issue that faces the children. Well, if you don't even know who you are, then what good can you be? And even a civil conversation then devolves into exclusive, you're in or you're out.
Well, and I would add, if I may, that I think it becomes really complicated because I am a privileged person. I'm white. I've had class stability. And many Jews have enjoyed a certain amount of privilege. And so I've been having this conversation when I went somewhere to talk about my book, and a woman came to me and said, well, Jews in Central Kentucky have never been minorities, that we've only experienced privilege. And I sort of said, well, that's not true, but I couldn't get her to see because all she could see was our privilege.
I might add, though, that I get this really interesting comment periodically when I'm in diverse groups, and they'll say that, you know, I thought you were white. Well, I look at my skin, I say, well, I think I am. But they mean white and Christian and Protestant predominantly is all that matters. The year before I got here, there was the incident at the stadium, what was then Appleby Stadium, when Clay's Mill Baptist Church held this event to celebrate faith in America. And the pastor effectively said, if you're not white and Protestant, you don't belong here. Hmm. Okay? You know, interesting dynamic there. Now, he didn't mean to be exclusive. He was trying to celebrate. Look at the world that's opened up for all of these people. There's groups, interfaith groups in town, that they understand interfaith means that the Protestants and the Catholics and the Eastern Orthodox and sometimes even the Mormons, because they all have Jesus in common. But if you don't have that, you're not a person of faith at all. So interfaith means only that group.
The purpose of our program today is learning and understanding and getting to know each other. And of course, Hanukkah being a good time to talk about Judaism. That was our idea in doing this program. We invite you to be part of the show, as David has done. He has called 800-621-8890. David, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with our guest. Go right ahead.
Thank you. Well, I know your principles there very well today. I grew up in Danville, Kentucky, and there were three very prominent Jewish families in Danville, the Bears, who had the Jacob Bear store, the Millers, who had the Cinderella store, and the Frankels, who had the Hub, which was our biggest department store. And I grew up in the same neighborhood with them. We all went to the same schools, and I babysat for years with the Bear children as they grew up. And then subsequent to that, I've lived in Lexington and Washington, D.C., and Mississippi, and New York City, Manhattan, and Berea, Kentucky. And I just can't say how much growing up in that, with those Jewish friends close in Danville, has really fully informed my and my children's lives and all the other places we've lived. And it's just sad that people don't have an opportunity to grow up with each other and understand each other's culture and really love and care about each other. And I'm just so glad I had that privilege in Danville.
Is that, David, because Danville is a community with, of course, a very prominent university, the college, Center College? Is that the reason that has been so for you, that you're in the academic community?
Yes. I've been in and out of the academic community in a lot of other different kinds of jobs. In very rural areas in eastern Kentucky, and I know that Rosie had some great stories, that I was very close to a Lebanese guy in Cumberland who ran the 10 cent store, Nicey Hazen, and it's fascinating to me how there really is in Kentucky an opportunity for all of us, Arabs, Jews, and Christians, or others, to have that kind of relationship in a way in which it turns out to be positive.
Very good. Well, thank you for your story, David. This is Eastern Standard. Our phone number is 800-621-8890. You can send us an email to wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Our guests, Rabbi Mark Klein and Rosie Musnick. We have talked a little bit about defining terms and the Jewish culture and religious beliefs. Jews were involved in some, and have been, and continue to be. And I know, Mark, you're very involved in the local community in terms of social issues and concerns about the community. And we have discussed racism and civil rights on this program. And am I not correct in that Jews have partnered quite a bit with the African-American community, with Roman Catholics, with others working for social justice and moving forward on what we might call progressive issues?
You know, the Torah says in Deuteronomy, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, justice, justice, or righteousness, righteousness you shall pursue. And I prefer the term righteous better than justice. Justice is the rule of law. We can do better than that. And our job is to make sure that we take care of the whole world and build relationships with each other. Some of my closest relationships have been formed because of the work that I've been privileged to be able to do as rabbi at Temple. I've become close with both imams in town. I study the Christian lectionary Wednesday mornings with a group of Christian clergy. And we find ourselves showing up at the same opportunities to bring a witness of healing and peace to the world. And so there's a lot of great stuff happening, and there are. And as David pointed out, we are blessed in this community to have the opportunity to form incredible and life-changing relationships. But that's part of what we all do. I don't think it's just the Jewish call to show up as part of the civil rights movement, although we always have. But we stood there with Christians, we stood there with Muslims, we stood there with Buddhists, we stood there with Hindus, because, you know, it's I think, godly to want to do the work of healing the world, and we're blessed to be part of that partnership.
And I think in terms of standing up for justice and rights with others, in terms of what terrible things happened to Jews during the Holocaust, World War II, how did that affect being Jewish in America, and other places that were not Nazi Germany?
Wow. That's another big question that's been handed to me, Rabbi.
I'll deal with it in a minute, but you've got the local take on it.
I got the local take. Well, how hasn't it affected us? I mean, I think any population that's been traumatized, it affects that population for generations to come. And several years ago, I went with my aunt and uncle, and my uncle was 90 at the time, driving to Frankfurt, which was, that was an experience in itself. But we went to hear a fellow who was representing Jewish genealogy, who came to Frankfurt at the History Center. And we went there, and we were shocked when we walked in, and we were the only Jews there. We were the prize guests.
We're going to take another short break. Sorry, the tyranny of the clock here interrupts us every once in a while, but we'll be back in a little more than a minute on Eastern Standard. We invite listeners to get on board with your questions, your comments, your personal stories, and we'll get back to Rosie Musnick here in just a moment. 800-621-8890 is our phone number. We're talking Hanukkah and Judaism on this week's Eastern Standard. You're invited to be part of the program by calling 800-621-8890, and we'll get to James, who is waiting on the line in just a few moments. And Rosie Musnick, we'll ask the rabbi in a minute about the music we just heard and its meaning related to Hanukkah as well. But you were talking about Jewish genealogy in Frankfurt.
Yes, that we went to this gathering, and the point I wanted to make, what the representative was saying to us, he told a story about a shtetl, a village, a Jewish village in Poland, where the Jews were gathered up and put in a barn, and the barn was lit on fire, and they were killed. And what penetrated me from that story was the extent to which that was my bone history, and that it was so much a part of me that it seeps in ways that you can't even expect, that you don't anticipate. Maybe for some people it means anxiety. Maybe it, you know, I was raised, and many Jews who I interviewed in Kentucky talked about that we have suffered, so we must empathize with those who are suffering. And how do you take that from being just a trite saying to something truly meaningful?
Certainly, it runs, and since the 1940s, is just going to run through the culture of Judaism and of our world, I guess, forever. I guess some would say that was then, this is now. The past is the past, and those terrible deeds of Hitler and the Nazis are behind us. Can it be? You know, will there be a time when it dissipates to the point where there will be Jews and other thoughtful people who just say, it's not even part of the psyche?
Well, you know, I joke sometimes that I wish I was Lutheran, you know, because who's thinking about Lutherans in this century, right? They're so, you know, innocuous. But I think for many Jews, there's a lingering fear. You know, we live a very comfortable life, and we live a comfortable life here in Kentucky. And I often point to Bernie Madoff, that he brought out this fear because he represented all the stereotypes that Jews don't want to be. And he was in the public eye. And there's this, I think when you have trauma like that, there's a lingering fear that, is that trauma going to come back? And also with all the difficulty in the Middle East, that you know, we remain in the public eye.
Let's go to the phones, and if James has been able to stay on the line with us, let's get him on the air. Thanks, James, for calling. I understand you're in a truck driving through.
I am. Getting ready to go through Lexington. I grew up north of Dearborn, Michigan, and it's a very diverse, very versatile area up there. A lot of it is Jews, and a lot of it is Arabs. A lot of them are in that one area, and the restaurants, the stores, and everything are in the area. But if one thing I found out by going through there and working in that area is a lot of people, if they look at an Arab or they look at, you know, you go to a Jewish synagogue or something like that, they all associate that. Even some of the Greek Orthodox are looked in the same way because of the way their ornate churches and stuff are looked at as kind of like almost the same connotation as Arabic. You know what I'm saying? They're not, as you stated earlier, the Protestant, you know, English-speaking white or whatever. And it's something that up in Michigan, it's really was driven home in Detroit. Another point that you brought out, too, that I thought was very interesting, and I wanted to elaborate on it, was, and I think the young lady was made a good point also, was about the Holocaust. If you look at the African-American community here in the United States, the big issue on the docket today is slavery. Well, because it happened here in the United States, it happened to them, their ancestry lies here in the United States. It's politically driven home more than, say, the Holocaust to the Jews. Whereas where I grew up, we learned about it in school books, but it wasn't really something that was talked about all the time. It was very rare to meet somebody who still had the tattoo on their arm or was even related. Whereas, you know, like I said, in the African American community, which exists in all the states, that seems to be, you know, not only a political issue in Washington or each state legislature, but more so an issue of prejudice and time here in the United States. I don't know if you guys are seeing the relevancy in that, but maybe the Jewish community would benefit a little bit more from being mainstream in the schools and offering up that education through government studies and such like that to help them, you know, everybody see the relevancy of what they went through. And not only that, the value of what they bring to the community as a whole.
Are you drawing maybe a parallel with Black History Month and efforts to teach Black history?
Pretty much. All the above. I mean, that's just it. There's the Jewish community is like a lot of different communities that came from that region that came over to the United States. They bring a lot of different qualities. There's government, there's business, there's art, there's culture. There's just like a lot of different people. And if you're going to look at them with any degree of prejudice, I don't believe that, you know, you should. I mean, in the United States, we're trying to understand, for instance, if you were talking about the Black, you know, Appreciation Week or getting to know the Black culture and stuff like that, that's actually being taught in schools. So something like the Jewish, I mean, the Holocaust was something that, you know, is etched in the minds of every Jew from then until now. And you know, not only that, you got that your culture alone, your religion, you guys celebrate your religion with more zest. You have, even your children have more of a knowledge of all the different aspects of your culture. You know what I'm saying? All the different symbolisms, the way you guys are in your synagogue and stuff. You guys seem more devout than the average Christian, at least in my view.
James, thank you for your observations. Let's get some reaction from Rabbi Mark Klein.
James, I appreciate that. The difficulty is that the Shoah, the Hebrew word is Shoah, which means destruction. The problem with the word Holocaust is the Holocaust offering that you find in the Bible is an atonement offering. And I would hate to think that we go out in history as having been an atonement offering, which some people have actually used that analogy. But that said, many states have passed legislation requiring Holocaust education in the schools. Kentucky used to have that law and undid that law. So in terms of teaching it in the schools, it's already part of curriculum. The difficulty is that when you teach this type of lesson in a segregated area in time or segregated curriculum, people point fingers and make presumptions separating it from the bigger picture of history. I would hate to think that we would teach that the Holocaust left victims, because there were certainly a huge victimization of not just Jews, 13 million people, 6 million of whom were Jewish, but 13 million people were victimized by Nazi Germany. And the fact is that we're still here making history while Nazi Germany is only read about in history. And if we're going to talk about appropriate education, and I would say across the board, whether we're talking about the African-American plight or the horrors that have been occasioned on any people throughout history, we need to talk about the fact that we're here to talk about it. And I think that's really an issue that we don't usually get to. But three things, I think, come back to your question, John, about resultant from the Shoah. One is there are people who became so entrenched in needing to protect themselves that they became hoarders or they became power mongers. Some of the slumlords that perpetuated the civil rights abuses were people were saying, no one else in the world is going to protect me, so I need to protect myself at all costs. And that's one camp. There's another group that just went completely into hiding. I don't want to be known as Jewish. I don't want to associate with Jews. Look what God did to my people, and I'm angry at the God I don't believe in. And the third piece, which I believe is really the predominant Jewish voice, and I think the predominant oppressed voice of any people moving forward, is we know the plight of the stranger, for we were strangers in the land of Egypt. And so there is this empathetic demand that we put upon ourselves to do the work of service and healing in the community. I think that's the most positive thing that comes out of this. So when you say, will there ever be a time where it doesn't govern our thoughts, I don't think you can erase these things from history. I don't think you can erase slavery from history. You can't erase the Inquisition or any of those things. But I would like to think that in their wake, we didn't leave the legacy of victimhood. We left the legacy of understanding the plight of those who were in need, and we can do the work because of those stories to bring healing to the breadth of the world.
Moving from victimhood to even beyond survivor, but maybe a form of victory, overcoming.
When we light candles on Yom HaShoah, the day that we remember the Holocaust, we have people who were liberators or survivors or family of survivors lighting one candle for each of the 6 million Jews. My insistence, we're also now having children from our community stand with them, because the children are the living legacy that we didn't die off, that there are people here still creating vibrant stories. And yes, there would have been more in the story. It's amazing what could have happened. But there's amazing things that are happening because we're still, not just Jews, but because people who have survived oppression are able to change the world.
Let's go back to the telephone. Crystal from Shelbyville is on the line at 800-621-8890. Crystal, thanks for calling. Go right ahead.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen. My question centers around converting to Judaism. I am not a person of faith myself. I didn't grow up going to church or connecting with any faith in particular, but I've kind of always felt connected to Judaism in my heart. Is it possible to truly convert and be accepted as a Jewish person in temple?
The earliest of rabbinic teachings says that someone who finds their faith amongst our people finds their faith amongst their people. There's no hierarchy. There's no probationary status. There's even this colloquial quip in the Talmud 1,600 years ago that says, someone who converts to Judaism, you're never allowed to remind them that their father ate pork. Huh. Okay? So I have rabbinic colleagues who are converts. It's about finding a place. And I'm going to use the word faith. You said you didn't grow up in faith. You may not have grown up in a religious tradition that made sense. But I think we all find faith in things that do make sense, culturally, communally, things like that. And people who go on those journeys, whether it's to Judaism or to Christianity, to Islam, etc., when you can find yourself at home, I think all religions from which I am familiar, which I teach a breadth of it, say that once you find yourself in faith in that place, you're there as authentic as anyone that's born there, lived there for many generations. That certainly would be true with us.
What about the process? How does that actually occur? I mean, are there lessons, instructions, if someone were to convert to Judaism?
You know, the tradition is I'm supposed to say no three times, but it's not because we're exclusive. It's because you need to make sure that you're not doing it to facilitate a marriage or because Madonna is studying Kabbalah or the fad or whatever. But there is a process to make sure that you understand that what you're getting into, that you're joining a tradition and a family that's thousands of years old and hopefully thousands of years to come, and that it does make sense for you. It's not a moment, a baptismal moment where you have God has called you to be a Jew. No, it's a process of, is this a life and a community and an ethic that makes sense for me long term, not just because of the short term reason that brought me to the rabbi's office.
Can I just add something too? I think Crystal, you touched on something that is really important, because and I'm learning from the rabbi here today, Rabbi.
Thanks, but Rosie. I appreciate
you're
that.
Welcome, Rabbi.
Doesn't rabbi mean teacher?
Oh yes, it does.
Some days we actually get to do that too.
Yes, it does. And my experience, and this has changed dramatically, but in the Jewish community I grew up in, there weren't many converts. You know, I grew up in a conservative congregation, and it was not welcomed. And I look back, and part of that was the suffering that came from World War II. There was a sense that we needed to shelter ourselves and sort of take care of ourselves. And that's not unlike any new immigrant group, where we sort of stay together. Maybe we live together, work together, and those sorts of things. So you're not wrong in thinking that there is sort of an in-group mentality, even a way of looking. You know, a friend of mine was saying that her converted husband, who's very, very blonde, that, you know, they turned their back when he went to synagogue, they turned their back on him. And that's,
well, unfortunately there are bigots and I'll use that term, in every walk of life, and some of that bigotry is self-protection and some of it is ignorance and all of that. But, you know, from the earliest of rabbinic commentaries, in fact there's a first century text where rabbis say that God loves converts more than people who were born Jewish, because they chose to do this. And so conversion isn't a 20th century phenomenon, which also demonstrates that we've never seen ourselves as a race, because you can't convert in or out of a race. And there are people who are born Jewish who walk into a synagogue and aren't necessarily always welcome either, as happens in any church or any mosque as well.
You're listening to Eastern Standard, and we're wrapping up today's program discussing Judaism and Hanukkah. Actually, you talk about, Crystal raised the issue of converting to Judaism, and you talk about welcoming. Do Jewish congregations welcome non-Jews? For instance, you know, Christian congregations talk about inviting people to come on in, and, you know, no matter what, everyone is welcome. Is everyone welcome in the temple or the synagogue?
Absolutely. Our most congregations have a cornerstone that will say, build me a home that I, God, may dwell amongst the people. Some will have, this is a house of worship for all people. But in every case, welcoming the stranger is a core value. And I like to colloquially tell visitors that, you know, you can come as often as you like. You don't get three visits and a pledge card. Okay? But, you know, it's important for us to know each other. As a caller before, as David said, you know, earlier, if the more we're exposed to each other, the more time we spend with each other, the less fear, the less ignorance, and the more appreciation we really have we can have for each other. People visiting us not only take from us, but leave something with us as well. And that's a gift for the world.
Beyond the synagogue on Friday evening or on Saturday or weddings and so forth, are there other ways that Judaism is celebrated in Kentucky in this last minute of our program? Are there Jewish festivals or events that our citizens may take advantage of to learn more about Judaism?
Well, I sort of joke that we're not like the Irish, you know, that we don't have a St. Patrick's Day parade or day where people are drinking. I don't know. What would it be if we had a Jewish day, Rabbi? Would it be like blue beer or something like that?
You know, Purim, any of the major festivals, the congregations have gatherings that are open to everybody, or should be open to everybody. But we, you know, for our kids, we have Purim Carnival. We invite everyone in to celebrate the stories of the Book of Esther for Hanukkah as well. It's easy for Hanukkah because there's the acculturation of the winter holidays that we end up in our schools celebrating both together as well. But there can never be too many opportunities to share with each other. So, you know, John, if you've got great ideas, we'd love to put them on the flagpole and raise it.
Well, at least we're at least having an opportunity to learn a little bit during 1 hour on the radio today. And again, Thursday being the final day of Hanukkah, I guess it's appropriate to say Happy Hanukkah.
It is. Thank you very kindly.
Thank you.
As we end Hanukkah for 2013. And we thank Rabbi Mark Klein of Temple Out of Israel for being with us today, and Rosie Musnick, sociologist and author. Her book, once again, Arab and Jewish Women of Kentucky, Stories of Accommodation and Audacity. I guess it's in the public library and available for purchase for those who are interested.
From UK Press, yes.
Great book, and
thank
Rosie
you.
Rocks.
Excellent. Thank
Rabbi
you.
Rabbi Rocks.
Thank you both,
Rockin
and thanks to our
Rabbi.
Callers and our listeners for being part of the show. Eastern Standard is a production of the WEKU stations at Eastern Kentucky University. Our associate producers are Andrew Moorhead and Richard Turner. Our technical director is Jonice Franklin. The show will be available online later today, Thursday, and will be able to be downloaded as a podcast, and it also repeats Sunday evening at 6. We're interested in hearing from you anytime. WEKU Eastern Standard @gmail.com. For WEKU, I'm John Hingsbergen. Thanks for tuning in.